From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm John Wells.
Our next guest is Tom Standage, whose new book, well, it's fascinating, and it's called A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Standage shines a light on many questions, including, will we even own cars in the future? Hard to picture that. What will our streets look like? Why are today's urban transport problems similar to the horse and carriage and horse manure days of the 1890s? We have lots to talk about. Tom Standage, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hello, it's great to be here.
Well, we're really pleased to have you. What a great book this is. Take us back even to the wheel, finding that point at which, I mean, there was a point that we didn't have the wheel, the use of the wheel in our everyday existence, yet we knew it existed.
Yes, the wheel is invented about 3500 BC, so about 5,500 years ago. And the funny thing is that we think of the wheel now as the greatest invention in history, but it took a surprisingly long time to catch on. And some civilizations knew about it and just said, well, we really can't see the point. Most famously, the Egyptians, they managed to build the pyramids entirely without using wheels, because moving big blocks of stone around was much easier using rafts on the Nile and then using sleds and wet sand. And in fact, no wheeled vehicle on Earth could have carried those great big blocks. So they managed to sort of not bother with them. It was only when the war chariot was invented, about 1500 BC, that they started paying attention, because the Hittites in what is now modern Turkey managed to conquer much of the nearby area, and the Egyptians were like, okay, now we can see the point of wheels. And so they got really into chariot building, and Tutankhamun is buried with a couple of chariots. They've got these big spoked wheels, and they're incredibly light. They weigh about 35 kilograms, and they're the sort of Ferraris of their day. And you see in the religious iconography of the time, pictures of kings and gods, they're always in chariots, because the chariot is like the coolest vehicle, and the faster you go and the cooler your vehicle, the cooler you are. And so that's really the beginning of the whole idea of you are what you drive. It goes all the way back to there. But in fact, there were then several other bumps in the road. You know, chariots fell out of fashion because cavalry turned out to be superior, and then knights on horseback became the coolest thing to be, and wheeled vehicles were considered to be just for women. And so this is where you get the idea of the knight and the princess. And the princess, of course, always travels in a carriage, and the knight always travels on horseback. So a lot of these ideas that we are very familiar with have these very, very deep roots and are connected to how we think about wheeled vehicles. So it all goes back a really long way.
Absolutely. You know, that saying, you are your car, as I look out into several parking lots here from our live studio, which is on the second floor, you know, I see a Tesla, I see another type of electric car, I see a really fancy Maserati or something like that, I see, you know, a big truck, and it harkens back to that you are your car. Oh, and I better mention the many, many Subaru Outbacks that are out there. That's really the car of Park City. And
excellent.
When you talk about you are your car, there is this thing that it is like an extension of people's, you know, ego, and to the degree that I think, at least in American culture, we're going to hold on to the individual car a lot longer than we probably ought to. What do you think about that?
No, I think that's absolutely true. It's very much an American idea that you are what you drive, much more so than in any other culture. And, you know, in much of the world, people can't afford cars, or they haven't got room for them. So in the dense cities of Asia, having a car is a complete nightmare. And there's very good public transport, there's ride hailing. You know, there's an entire generation of Chinese who are skipping car ownership, you know, may not go through that period at all, and have gone straight to ride hailing. Because having a car, it's very difficult to get a permit, there's nowhere to park it, it's very expensive. Why bother? And in fact, you see that for young people today, the technology that that they use for self-expression rather than cars in much of the world is the smartphone. It's the technology that grants you social freedom, the ability to meet up with people, the ability to go shopping whenever you like, the ability to access entertainment. That's what the car was for teenagers in the US in the 40s and the 50s, and that's what the smartphone is now for teenagers everywhere in the world. So, obviously the impact of American car culture and American teenage culture, which are kind of the same thing. I mean, the car is absolutely central to teenage culture because it grants the teenagers this independence, which allows them to sort of break away from their parents. And that's that's the sort of basis of it. That has had an enormous influence, obviously, on the rest of global culture. But I think in the same way that that culture was exported around the world, and people around the world now know about things like high school proms and drive-ins and all the rest of it, the culture that's now calling the shots is Chinese teenage culture. So things like TikTok, things like live-streamed e-commerce, there's a whole load of business models and a whole load of behaviours that are coming out of China, and they're not based on the car anymore. They're based on the smartphone.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are speaking with Tom Standage. His new book, A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Well, it wasn't just the kids in the 40s and the 50s. I mean, I went to high school in the late 60s, and we used to talk about cars all the time. And we used to be able to be on a highway and have cars fly by us, and we'd be able to tell from their tail fins exactly what kind of car they were, if it was six-cylinder, eight-cylinder, all of those different things. It was a really exciting time. I recently had a conversation with somebody who was considering buying a Mustang or a Corvette, and we just went through all the different, checklist items on what the engine was all about and what you get here and there. And it's fun to have those conversations, but you don't have as many of them as you used to.
No, that's true. I'm with you, right? I was born in the 60s. I grew up in the 70s, and I was obsessed with cars. And I still love, I see a car on the motorway. I'm like, what is that car? I was driving the other day, and I was overtaken by a DeLorean. Can you believe there are DeLoreans on the road that actually work? It's amazing. When I go to China, it's hilarious because I feel really uncomfortable that I can't recognize every single car that I see immediately. I can't place it. I can't go, that's a Nissan, that's a Lotus, that's a Ferrari.
But you used to.
Well, you can't in China, because in China they've got these completely different car brands. I mean, you see all the Teslas, obviously, and you see the Audis, but they've got these other brands, and so you can't recognize them. And I hadn't realized how central, the ability to recognize cars was to the way I look at the world until I went to China and couldn't recognize any of them. So, this book is not an attack on cars. This book is a social history of the car. And it says maybe we've gone a little bit too far with our love of the car, and maybe we're starting to dial it back a bit. And in fact, even in America, people are learning to drive later. Fewer teenagers have a driver's license. We're seeing that the average, the number of miles being driven each year is going up, but it's going up more slowly than the number of vehicles or the number of people. So the average number of miles being driven per year by, per vehicle and per person is going down. And it actually peaked in 2004, and it's back to the levels it was in the 90s. So I think what's really happening here is that although we like the freedom that cars give us, cars also impose costs on us. It's becoming more and more inconvenient to own cars in many ways, whether it's because of traffic, whether it's because you have to buy permits to park them in certain places or drive them in certain places, and so on. And then the alternatives to cars are becoming easier to access and more convenient, at least for people who live in cities. So if you live in a city, you can use public transport much more easily, because Google Maps will tell you where the next bus is coming or the next train. You can call something, an Uber or a Lyft with your phone. You can use scooter rental and bike rental. And we're starting to see apps that stitch all of this together. And I call this the Internet of Motion. And it's where you combine all of these different modes of transport into something that in some cities you can actually just pay a monthly fee for. So in Berlin or in Helsinki, you can pay a certain amount per month just for unlimited non-car travel. And in fact, sometimes you get things like use of a car on the weekend if you pay a bit more for it. So I think the alternatives to car ownership are becoming more appealing to more people. Not for everybody. And obviously in rural areas or in exurbs where there isn't public transport, you are going to need a car. So I'm not saying cars are going away. But I'm just saying the number of people for whom not owning a car makes sense is going up. And I think we may have passed peak car. And you know, I think that would be a good thing, because we've seen during the pandemic that actually giving space in the streets to things other than cars can be very nice. And maybe we should go back in that direction to the world before the car, when you know, the streets weren't just the places where the cars were and you'd better get out of the way, because that's what ended up changing and that's what ended up happening.
Oh, it's fascinating when you say in the rural parts of the country, you still may need to have a car. When it was the rural parts of the country that weren't exactly excited about going towards the car when they had horses, because they didn't have the manure problem of the city. You know, this whole transition from horse to auto is interesting. My grandfather, born in 1895, had a conversation with me when I was a kid. And he was a first generation from Germany, lived on the eastern shore of Maryland, very rural area. And he told me the story of when he was a young man and the pressure to move from horse to auto. And he was a holdout. He was reluctant to do it. And I imagine that these types of conversations, horse versus car, were happening all throughout our country and your country.
Yes, they were. And that's why I think that period of history is very worth looking at today, because what happened in the 1890s was people realized that horse-based transport was unsustainable. If you went to the biggest, fastest-growing cities like London and New York, they had the manure literally piling up in the streets. And they had the big problem was that the population of horses was growing faster than the population of people. So you needed more and more horses per person to deliver everything that people wanted. Trains made it worse, because the more easily you could move goods and people in and out of cities, the more you need horses to move goods and people around inside cities. And there was just traffic all the time. There were accidents. There was an amazing amount of noise. People were worried about the health impact of the horse manure, aside from the smell and the fact that it went everywhere. And so there was this recognition that things weren't, you know, you couldn't continue down this path, because you were going to end up with like more horses than people and nowhere to put them. And so, you know, obviously advocates of the automobile said, well, this will solve all your problems. There will be no horse manure, so the pollution problem is gone. There will be no traffic, because a car, a horseless carriage, only takes up half as much space as a horse and a carriage. So you free up half of the street space, so boom, all the traffic goes away, you know. And also they can go faster, so that means you can make more efficient use of the streets. There won't be any more accidents, because, you know, you can scare a horse and it'll kick you, or it might be surprised by a loud sound, but that will never happen with a car, so you'll be fine. And they'll be quiet, they'll be silent, because cars have rubber tires instead of these iron-rimmed wheels clattering over the cobblestones. And so it was really going to, you know, they really claimed that it was going to solve all these problems. And of course, they were wrong on absolutely all of those counts. The pollution is invisible, but it's just as dangerous in the form of particulates and carbon dioxide. The accidents went up, way up. The amount of traffic went up, way up. We ended up building all these roads and they just fill up with cars. And the noise, you know, there's all the engines revving and the horns beeping and so on. The average speed of traffic in London in the 1890s was 8 miles an hour. The average speed of traffic in London today is 8 miles an hour. So it turned out that what looked like a fix to this unsustainable problem made a whole load of things worse and introduced its own problems. And here we are today in the 2020s, and we're going, well, we've realised that the dominant means of urban transport is unsustainable, which is exactly what they realised in the 1890s. And we're saying, well, what do we fix it with? And, you know, how should we change? So I think we need to avoid making those similar sorts of mistakes again. And when people come and say, hey, you know, electric cars is going to fix everything, or autonomous cars are going to fix everything, I think we need to not be betting all of our chips on one option. And that's why I'm such a fan of this use of multiple different transport methods stuck together in an internet of motion, because I think that gives us a lot more flexibility. And it means that we won't have our cities bent out of shape by one particular form of transport. And it also means you can have different mixtures in different cities. And, you know, it may be that different mixtures are appropriate in different cities. So that's why I think it's really worth learning the lessons of history today, in particular, and going back and looking at that period where the car first hit the road.
I sometimes wonder, Tom, if there is the amount of outcry about doing away with people's precious parking and their precious personal automobile as there, you know, was there as much outcry back when they were switching from horse and carriage to the automobile? Because it seems to me now that we are holding so tightly to these things. I mean, granted, Park City is by no means a huge city, and we have a wonderful free bus system here. But a lot of people think that, oh, that's for other people to take, not for me to take. And we just recently, one of our main roads in through our Old Town area, we just did away with parking on one side of it so that we could fit in a quite an ample bike path. And you should hear the outcry and the bad words that are, you know, being thrown around and the name calling to the city officials who decided on this ridiculous idea. And yet, at the same time, we have this burgeoning electric bike, population here. Everyone's got an electric bike, and so do all the tourists, apparently, because they're all riding up and down, and they're not in cars all the time. Of course, they still want their cars. So, you know, that push and pull of this whole thing, I'm just curious about what you think about our eagerness or our resistance.
Yeah, no, I think, well, this is inevitable. What we learned in the 20th century is no matter how much space you give cars, it's never enough. It's never, ever enough. You just build more roads, they just fill up with more cars. So you can never win, right? So given that you can never give them enough space, the really interesting thing we've seen in 2020 during the pandemic is all of these experiments all over the world where cities have tried lots of different things. It's like, let's give some space to some other things. Let's have restaurants out in the streets. Let's pedestrianize things. Let's try bike lanes. Of course, the motorists hate it. The motorists always hate it, right? Everything is terrible and everything should be cleared away for the car and the car should be supreme. But, you know, they're never going to be satisfied, right? That's the thing. And many of us are in two minds about this because we're both car owners and car drivers, but we're also at other times we're motorists or cyclists. So I'm really trying to see both sides of this and saying, you know, the only way we're going to get people to switch away from cars is if you make car ownership more painful and more arduous and less convenient. And so some of the time that pain and that inconvenience affects me, but when it does, I say, well, actually, this is for the greater good, and I should go and identify and investigate these alternatives a bit more closely. I mean, I don't drive up to Central London. I haven't done that for years because it's just become so nightmarish. And I live at the end of the road from a station, so I can just walk down to the station. So I have moved a lot of my shopping at the weekends. If I would have previously driven up, I'll now go by train. And I take Ubers if, you know, I'm going to my kids' parents' evening because I don't want to face sitting in the car and I don't want to face parking. So it's just like easier to get an Uber and that kind of stuff. So I think you're only going to push people away from cars if you make car ownership painful. And that means you're going to have these howls of protest. So I'm afraid it's part of the process, and it's a sort of necessary side of things. The thing about switching from horses to cars is that a lot of people just did it because it was cheaper and it was easier. And owning a horse was expensive. You had to feed it all the time, and cars just were more convenient. But then people started taking things for granted, like the I should just be able to park it on the street and leave it. You never did that with a horse and carriage, right? Yeah. Because you had someone sitting in it all day and they had to feed the horse. And, you know, but as soon as you had cars, it was like, okay, I now demand the right to park everywhere. And we really just let that get out of hand in the 20th century. So I think having the pendulum swing back a bit now is not such a bad thing.
Right. And let's talk just about the infrastructure and the amount of land in this country that is dedicated to parking the car.
Okay, it's roughly 6 car parking spaces for every person, for every car. And about 30% of the area of a typical US city is parking. And this is because of rules that came in the 50s, where when you build a new retail or residential building, you have to provide a certain amount of parking. And this was to ensure that there would be enough parking when people drove to it. And that just means it's a massive, massive waste of space. But the way one urban planner put it to me was, if we could get people to use fewer cars, then in effect, we've banked an awful lot of land, and it's prime real estate, right? It's in the middle of cities. And so we can then use that for housing, we could use it for parks. We could use it in other ways. So in effect, we've got this sort of saving. We've got all this land saved up that we could be using in different ways if we were less dependent on cars. So I think that would be good. And also, you know, there are new ways of going shopping. You can order stuff online and have it brought to you. You don't necessarily need a car for that. You can use car sharing clubs. You can use ride hailing. You can use all sorts of things within cities, at least, as alternative to cars. And they are just getting better and better and easier to access. So I hope that's the direction we'll be going in, because, you know, it does make the quality of life in cities much better. The other thing is people hate commuting, right? So working from home has been great because you're not wasting all that time sitting in the car. That's one of the most stressful things in some people's lives is commuting. It's the thing they hate the most about their week. So no one's sad to see the back of that, surely. So all of these factors, I think, are pointing in the same direction, which is less dependence on cars. Not to say that cars are going to go away completely. I don't think they are. Horses haven't gone away. But I think the pendulum is swinging towards becoming less dependent on them, at least for people who live in cities. And most people in the world now live in cities.
Tom, if you researched this book, what most surprised you?
Ooh, that's a good question. I suppose it was that there are so many kind of random choices. I mean, why red is stop and green is go, why we drive on the left or we drive on the right. An awful lot of it was just random, right? No one really chose it. No one really decided it. And then you kind of get stuck with it. and so you get what's called path dependency, which is where some random decision is made at some point and then everyone is stuck with it and it's too difficult to change away from it. And it's sort of appropriate that in the history of transport, you get this amazing degree of path dependency. So I suppose it was finding those things out. And then probably the funniest thing, and this goes back to being a car nerd again, is I was amazed when I read about the Model T. The number of cars on the road in the US went from about 8,000 in 1900 to about 8 million in 1920. So that is a 1,000-fold growth over 20 years. 2 to the power 10 is 1,024. So that's basically doubling every 2 years. That is Moore's law growth for a massive great piece of metal, which is incredible. So that shows you how incredible what Henry Ford did was. But the other thing is that a modern driver would not be able to drive a Model T at all. It has three pedals, but none of them do what you think they do. The left one is reverse. The middle one, I can't remember what the middle one does. I mean, none of them. I mean, and the gas is like next to the steering wheel. So basically, if you or I got into a Model T, we would crash it straight away. So I can't believe anyone drove these things.
Thomas, we don't have a lot of time left, but quickly, who was Henry Bliss and what was the significance of his death in September of 1899?
He was the first pedestrian killed by a car in the US, and it was actually an electric car, because electric cars, the most popular cars sold in 1897 were electric, and there were quite a lot of electric taxis on the roads then. So yes, he was the first person. The automobile has tasted blood, as one newspaper headline put it. And of course, you know, he's the first of many. More Americans have died on the roads this century than died in all the wars America has ever fought. And that's modern cars with modern safety features. So cars kill a lot of people.
Tom Standage, it's been such a pleasure having you speak with us on Cool Science Radio. The new book is A Brief History of Motion, From the Wheel to the Car to What Comes Next. Tom Standage is also the deputy editor of Economist Magazine. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank
you.
It's been great.
All right. Take care.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.